Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in History. I am your host, Rob Denning. Today I am speaking with Dr. Tom Rust about his new book, Watching Over Yellowstone, the U.S. Army's Experience in America's First National Park, 1886 to 1918, which was just published today on June 5th, 2020 by the University Press of Kansas. Professor Rust, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And just a quick correction, Watching Over Wonderland was the intended title, but the editors thought nobody knows what Wonderland was anymore because that was an old-fashioned term for Yellowstone. So now it's officially called Watching Over Yellowstone.
Watching Over Yellowstone. Okay. All right. Well, Watching Over Yellowstone, the U.S. Army's Experience in Yellowstone National Park, 1886 to 1918. Great. Well, before we get into the book and talk more about that, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, you bet. I'm a native Montana, and I grew up in Bozeman, Montana, which is only about 90 miles north of Yellowstone Park. So that probably explains some of my love for Yellowstone. And we used to go there all the time as a kid, and just even for a Sunday afternoon drive, we'd go into the park and see the wildlife and go to see Old Faithful. I've seen Old Faithful every single year of my life, so I take that with pride because I have an ongoing love affair with Yellowstone. So I graduated from the University of Minnesota in 1992, interestingly enough, with a degree in classical history and a minor in classical studies. But then I after that, when I went for my master's degree, I got my master's degree mostly in American history. I had a minor field in early modern Europe. And I ended up then also getting a second master's degree in education because I decided I wanted to be a high school teacher, go back to my original intent when I went to college, which was I was going to be a football coach and a history teacher, kind of my worst stereotypes now. But after I got my master's degree, but I pretty much priced myself out of the market with two master's degrees by that point. So, but I fell into a job at Montana State University Billings at that point and decided that I loved teaching college. College was great, and ended up getting my PhD from the University of Leicester in England. And which was a phenomenal experience. And I've been teaching at Montana State now for 21 years, done a number of different jobs there in addition to teaching, including running the honors program. And I was the state coordinator for Montana National History Day for a while. I was a service learning coordinator. Now I'm currently also the faculty athletic representative on campus too. So I've worn many hats and a long period of time teaching at Montana State Billings. So, but I was lucky enough to teach in Montana, which is where I want to be. So.
And so it sounds like you've had a long history with the area and a long interest in Yellowstone, but can you talk about the specific origins of this book? Where did it come from? Did it develop out of a research project in grad school, or how did this come about?
Actually, no. This was one of those things that eventually I kind of always had in the back of my mind since the early 90s, before I even completed my master's degree. I worked in Yellowstone Park in the concessionaires. I was the controller at Bridge Bay Marina. I was a cashier and then an assistant controller at Lake Lodge and then the controller at Bridge Bay Marina, which is kind of funny. A historian with math anxiety being an accountant is like living a Woody Allen movie. But living in Yellowstone, you have to realize, especially back in the 90s, first of all, there's no television in the park at all. It used to drive visitors nuts, and they were amazed. They'd go to these beautiful hotels, and there's no television. There was also back then no internet access. And so, you know, what do? Well, you hang out with your friends, and you talk with people, and you hike and camp, but you also read, and you read a lot. And so as I was there and we were reading, I was reading one of the books at the time. Well, there were two books at the time that I was reading. One's called The Yellowstone Story by Aubrey Haynes, who used to be the park historian. And then the other one was Death in Yellowstone by Lee Whittlesey, which is just came out in one of the years I was teaching there. And both of them touched on the military era in Yellowstone. And I was like, oh, this is great. I need to know more about this. You know, I was in the middle of grad school. It was during the summer of just before I defended my master's thesis, which was on the military in Montana at a place called Fort Ellis. And so I was like, oh man, this is great. So, you know, as historians do, we read books all the time and we need to know. And, you know, once you get that interest, you start trying to find out. Well, I found out there wasn't much written other than one other book by a professor at the University of Montana that had talked about the military era. And most of the time it's kind of tangential to the development of the National Park Service and how the military came in and provided the operational structure for the Park Service ranger program. And it's almost always very positive. And but I did notice, of course, you know, being highly fluent in those kinds of issues regarding social history, being in grad school and being, you know, immersed in that, in those kinds of discussions, that almost all the works focused largely on the administrative aspects, the superintendents, the decisions they made, and how that built into or kind of faded into the National Park Service. And so as a social historian, my first and primary love is social history. I was like, what about the soldiers? Well, there was always occasional little anecdotes in some of those other ones about it, but I always wanted to explore what was it like to be a soldier in Yellowstone. You know, these guys coming from, you know, New York City, and they come to Yellowstone, and, you know, what's it like? First of all, they're soldiers. They didn't necessarily sign up for that, and then they end up going to Yellowstone. I mean, that's a whole different world than New York City, to be sure. And I was probably particularly attuned to that because as a manager in the park, I had employees from all around the country. And some of them, the idea of Yellowstone was a little bit more than what the reality of Yellowstone was like for them. And some, you know, particularly from urban environments, man, they were just kind of freaked out by the wilderness and how much wilderness and how isolating Yellowstone could be. And so, you know, being aware of different people's reactions to Yellowstone kind of made me a little bit attuned to that, because my reaction, having grown up here and, you know, had spent every moment that, you know, my family could in the park, you know, it was very interesting. And so that idea just kind of germinated, but, you know, I'd had that, I'd already had my master's thesis going. And so I finished that up, and then, you know, my doctoral dissertation, you know, it was a little bit different. It actually is in comparative frontier studies with ancient Rome and the American West, and with a lot of archaeology. So I, you know, had these things and new things. I was always back there, and the new projects pop up every once in a while and that I hadn't anticipated. So got there. But then, you know, once I got, I'm fully promoted, you know, I got tenure, got fully promoted. You know, it was like, okay, what do you want to do now? Well, you know what? I want to do this. I've been sitting on this idea for 20 years. It was time to do it. And so I was lucky enough to get a sabbatical and, you know, the minimal funding that I needed to go do some archival work and was able to do this. So it was really more of a labor of love than anything.
Yeah, and that really comes through in the book itself. It's as we were saying before we started recording here, I think it's a fun book because it talks about the daily lives of the soldiers. And as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the books that have been written before that had focused on the officer class. And so your desire to focus on the soldiers themselves, how do you find the stories of the soldiers? What was your source base? How did you build this reconstruction of the soldiers' lives?
Well, fortunately, I'd kind of done a little bit of that in some of my previous works. My master's thesis, which I turned into a book on Fort Ellis in Montana, I found that a number of different sources were very useful. One, newspapers would relate it. Occasionally, there's diaries, but not as many as obviously you would like. But one of the richest sources that I found were the court-martial records, the general court-martial. Now, there's two types of court-martial records. There's kind of the what are called the garrison court-martial, which are kind of the minor offenses, if you will. And, you know, there's not a lot of testimony that's recorded. But the general court-martial records turned out to be a very, very rich source of material for the common soldiers, so much so that, you know, you have testimony and dialogue in some cases, particularly in one very, very long court martial about a murder where in the winter time, where there's these isolated posts throughout the park where they would patrol for poachers, and they would basically put five guys in the middle of nowhere. I mean, quite literally nowhere. And then it snows 120 to 180 inches in various parts of the park. And so these guys are cut off from everybody. And a relatively unpleasant episode happened where there was some tension. These guys didn't like each other really to begin with. And they were there for a year. And so over the summer, they already didn't like each other. And then it turns into a murder kind of a mutiny, and the sergeant involved with or in charge of the station ends up killing one of his subordinates, a private, and shooting another one. And the testimony was over 120 pages of testimony and stuff. And so, I mean, you can really get a feel for, in my opinion, I thought a real feel for, you know, how, you know, the soldiers were interacting with one another, how they were interacting with tourists, what it was like to be locked up. I mean, I always kind of thought over the recent COVID isolation, well, at least it's not as bad as what those guys had to go through, for sure. Because I could still have Zoom meetings, and, you know, if I needed to go to the grocery store and stuff. But, oh man, those guys were locked in there. And so the court martial records really were a very, very, very rich source of material.
Yeah, and I think that provides us a good kind of segue into the content of the book, because much of the book is talking about this tension that soldiers that were stationed at Yellowstone had, because, as you mentioned, a few of them were ready for it. Few of them wanted to be there, and it turned and so they turned into all kinds of shenanigans. So let's turn to the book. And so what, from your sense and from your reconstruction of the sources, what was life like for these soldiers at Yellowstone? Well, first off, let's talk about why they were there in the first place.
Sure. Yellowstone was in many ways kind of ahead of its time, and we take for granted what the idea of a national park is and should be. But you have to realize Yellowstone is the first national park, really is, you know, they're writing the book, they're writing the playbook on this. And there was no blueprint, there was no idea. And it's kind of funny, you watch the Ken Burns documentary on the national parks. And, you know, it says, oh, it's the America's best idea. It's very, you know, kind of, you know, praiseworthy. Oh, it was great and all that. And it's the element of democracy. It's the best thing. You know, it's truly democratic. Well, that's true. But democracy is a messy thing. And I think especially right now, we're seeing that play out quite literally in the streets. And the idea of the national park was pushed largely by the railroads, and the idea that, you know, we have this wilderness, and, you know, and it's tied in with the greater culture idea of what is wilderness and what is the frontier, and the frontier is starting to disappear. And this area had very little economic value other than its natural splendor. You weren't going to be able to, you know, farm it for sure, because it's, you know, it's at 8,000 feet and the soil's, you know, kind of rocky and it's mountainous. And so they create this national park, but they really didn't know what that meant. You know, it's for the enjoyment of the people and all of that. And that sounds great and all that. And the railroads want to exploit it. They want to bring tourists in because the railroad comes through and they already you know, are thinking about how can we get people to ride across the, you know, the Northern Pacific Railroad, and starting to think about how to get people out here onto trains. And so they are one of the major players in trying to put that, but they're envisioning this idea of these resorts, if you will, like you see back east, you know, these rich person resorts where these little, you know, people come, the playground of the wealthy, if you will. And so you have that element that's going on. But on the other hand, you also have a local populace that has been using the parks for a different idea. I mean, sure, they, you know, even in the early 1870s, you know, a few people are kind of coming through and there's not a thriving industry, but they're slowly growing. You know, these local people that are putting up little shanty hotels and whatnot. But there's also local people that are going in and they're hunting the game there, which is very abundant even then. And they're hunting the game to the point of just slaughtering it. And they're, you know, they're doing things like hunting elk just for the eye teeth, not even for the meat. They'll hunt it for the eye teeth. They'll hunt it for the antlers. They'll hunt bison for the heads alone, not any of the meat as well. And some of them are hunting for subsistence. Some of them are hunting for trophies. Some of them are, you know, they're using the park in a very different way. And then you start adding into the political element of it too, about, you know, because nobody knows, again, what a national park should be and who is it really for. And funding for the park is always problematic. Even today, funding for national parks is, you know, I mean, is somewhat controversial, especially different projects of the park. And so there becomes this whole debate about, you know, what should we be doing with the park? How should we patrol it? Should we lease it out to people and let, you know, kind of sublease it, let business take care of policing it? Do we hire people? And they hire people to try to do it. And it changes with the political administration, whatever administration is in the White House. It changes with however Congress is composed at any given time. And ultimately, it gets to be such a mess that, really, there was a movement to get rid of it, to get rid of the national park, to open it up to private development, just get rid of the park altogether and let probably the railroads or you know, some other business take over the park and let them have it as kind of a private thing and do with it what they will. And at that point, Phil Sheridan, who was a loved the park. He'd gone several tours there. He was absolutely dismayed by what he had seen as far as the poaching and the just wanton destruction of wildlife in the park, that he came up with this idea, hey, we need to do something and I'll bring the army. He's the general of the army at that point. He says, I'll bring the army and I'll bring soldiers in and we'll police this. Which is very interesting, given the fact that he had some experience with Reconstruction and the army performing police type duties. At the same time, that was very uncomfortable for the army. I mean, the Reconstruction element, was very fresh. You know, you have to realize it's 1877 is when Reconstruction ends, and here we are, you know, 1880s, and we're seeing, you know, that's still a fairly fresh memory. And the idea of performing those types of law enforcement duties was not comfortable either for military people. The upper echelons of an officer corps of the army were very uncomfortable with those duties, as were the increasing number of senators and congressmen who had experienced the use of the army in terms of these types of duties, both in the South, but then also in the labor unrest in the North, you know, things like the railway strike and stuff like that, where, you know, the army had come in on the side and performed these law enforcement duties. And so there was a real tension there with that. But Sheridan loved the park so much that he said, I'll bring in troops. Well, it ends up being kind of a big political problem that some people who at first had supported the park eventually decided they kind of want to do away with it. And they had they basically withdrew funding to support any type of law enforcement activity in the park by the federal government. And therefore, there had been a rider several years before, in like 1882, that said, well, if called upon by the Secretary of the Interior, the U.S. Army will bring troops into the park. And so in order to save the park, basically, the Secretary of the Interior asked Sheridan to send troops into the park because his funding was cut, basically eliminated, that would provide any kind of law enforcement. So Sheridan sent troops into the park in 1886. Nobody knew how long they were going to be there. And it was not a nice clean cut job description either, because, you know, who do they report to? Well, partially they report to the Secretary of the Interior, partially to the War Department. The soldiers who are there, this isn't necessarily what they signed up for. This wasn't the job they wanted. They expected when they signed up. I mean, there's a whole variety of reasons why people joined to be soldiers. Not all of them wanted to necessarily be soldiers, but they knew what they were getting themselves into as being soldiers. And going in and being policemen of the park what we would call, you know, rangers, if you will, that wasn't necessarily what they had signed up for. And especially the unique social situation in the park, where most of the tourists that came through were wealthy people who could afford to take a week off, ride the train across the country, go to Yellowstone and have, you know, this 5-day tour, grand tour, that was paid for, or that you paid for, that took you to all the different places and all these lavish hotels and stuff. You know, they were very wealthy, whereas the soldiers, the common soldiers at least, were, you know, a little bit excluded from that. And, you know, as much as America likes to envision ourselves as a classless society, particularly in the, you know, mid to late 19th century, you know, there was definitely some class distinctions that led to some of the tension that was going on.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is the Gilded Age, and you know, our conception of the Gilded Age was this rising inequality, different class structures, and all of that, and so it makes sense that there would be kind of this class conflict, maybe too far to put it, but at least some sort of class tension happening out here, where you've got lower class folks who are generally the people in the army first, and then you've got all these wealthy tourists. And there is an interesting passage in the book about the soldiers kind of taking a little bit of glee, maybe, or interest in rigorously enforcing the rules of the park against the wealthier folks, and just basically to watch the wealthy folks squirm a bit.
Yeah, and I like how the wealthy tourists kind of push back on that. They do not like, under any circumstances, these people who they perceive as their social inferiors as having that legal authority over them. And, you know, they'll write the commanding officer. One of my favorite elements of that was they used to do what were called bear shows. The hotels would take their garbage and they'd basically take it out to a field, and then bears would come every night and tourists would go and they'd watch it. And soldiers were there to make sure that, you know, nobody got hurt and that tourists keep themselves away. Well, there was one episode where, you know, the soldier just basically, you know, kind of berated some of the tourists for getting too close, and they didn't like that. And they wrote the commanding officer about, oh, how insolent this guy was and how terrible he was. And yeah, I mean, it was, and they just weren't used to being talked that way. And he ruined their whole experience of watching these bears feast on garbage because he was, you know, trying to enforce the rules. And he did it probably might have done it a little aggressively, but, you know, there was some tensions there because they weren't allowed to go into the hotels. I mean, they were, you know, in some cases just a couple hundred yards away. You know, Fort Yellowstone in Mammoth is, you know, only 200 yards from this big lavish hotel, and they could see these rich people come and they could see the lifestyle. They had these dances and whatnot, but soldiers weren't allowed to partake in it. And they could see this stuff, this class structure that, you know, excluded them explicitly. And so, you know, some tensions might've built up there. And, I tried to bring in I'm also an archaeologist, so I have my feet in both worlds of archaeology and history. And I was fortunate enough to be able to be granted access to some of the archaeology reports. And, you know, people weren't allowed to bring guns into the park, or if they did, they were kind of bound up and checked periodically to make sure that, you know, people weren't hunting with their weapons. But at one of the soldier stations, man, they sat on the deck, and we could tell this because there were so many, you know, cartridge casings laying around. They sat there on their front deck and just shot a crazy number of bullets. So they're just sitting there, you know, shooting stuff away. Interestingly enough, alcohol was not supposed to be served in the park as well. And, you know, soldiers would enforce that periodically as well. But at the same time, they would also we found numerous archaeologists found numerous alcohol and beer bottles around. And so, you know, I just have this vision of these guys, you know, they're so pissed off at the tourists, they're just sitting there drinking beer and shooting guns on the front porch of their soldier station when the tourists aren't around. So
yeah, yeah, that does present a really interesting image there.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So let's talk a little bit about the soldiers themselves. One of the running themes of the book really seems to be that soldiers who are trained to fight wars were instead called upon to do very different things when they were stationed at Yellowstone. So what were some of the duties of these soldiers at Yellowstone, and why did that seem to clash so much with the military culture or the military training?
Well, they, I mean, it's interesting because they still had to perform military duties. Let's be clear that this was a pretty major fort. You know, it had a couple hundred soldiers there at any given time, and the numbers vary over the years. And they still had to do rifle training. So there's a rifle range just inside the park, actually, from Gardner. They had to march and drill. There was a machine gun platoon there, which I always thought was kind of funny because having worked in the park, there might have been times where you would be tempted to use that on tourists. But, you know, why would soldiers have a machine gun platoon in Yellowstone? They drew up plans for a mock attack. What would happen if Fort Yellowstone was attacked? And I'm like, well, who's going to attack it? I mean, a bunch of renegade tourists, or, you know, I don't see that happening. But nonetheless, they had to continue to perform those duties, but on top of which they would perform at any given post, you know, around. I mean, you would perform these duties. You'd learn to march and drill. You would do, and the inspection records, which I thought were another great source. Very rich source. They'll talk about how, you know, these soldiers, there are some things they need to really work on because they are distracted from their military duties. And this is that messiness I was talking about. You know, what job are they doing? Are they doing the job that the War Department wanted them to do, or are they doing what the Interior Department? And trying to serve both masters was hard because, you know, on the annual inspections, man, they weren't always doing what they needed to be doing. They didn't march well. They didn't always have the best horsemanship skills and things like that. So they have to do all that. But then on top of that, the unique duties of the park, they had to check tourists in. They had to make sure tourists came in. They registered them, just like, you know, when you go into national parks today, there's that little check post there. They check them in. They would inform them of the rules. They would, if they had guns, they had to bind them up so that they would do that, so that they couldn't use them and hunt game in the park. They had to patrol the park for poachers, which is, you know, it's a policing type duty where they would go and they would kind of and here maybe there's a little overlap with their duties, but maybe not as much as you might think, because, you know, the cavalry at the time is set up to, you know, be an open field and do maneuvers as units, you know, whether it be, you know, from platoons to battalions, whatever, you know, and here you've got, you know, just a couple of guys going through the park at a time, trying to hunt down poachers and people that are doing other illegal activity in the park. And the soldiers were so ill prepared for that because they're not used to, you know, marching in small groups, hunting poachers. They don't, many of them have never been in the mountains before. They don't understand. And units rotated through so often that by the time they figured out the park, they were usually out. So they're not familiar with the terrain. They don't understand the wildlife. So they had to hire scouts, which again is a military tradition of in the West of, you know, hiring people because the U.S. cavalry didn't understand Native Americans and the tactics that would be used in field maneuvers against them. So they would hire people that understood it to be the scouts, oftentimes other Native Americans, other tribes. And so this was kind of a tradition, but you hear they would hire locals that understood the park, use them as scouts to try and hunt them. And so the soldiers become, you know, kind of, you know, the muscle, if you will. And they just kind of follow the scouts around. So anyway, they're hunting the poachers, which actually could be a fairly dangerous deal because poachers, there was kind of an organized poaching ring in Island Park, Idaho, just outside the park to the west, that would come in and hunt and game and then ship it off, take the meat and ship it off to the mining fields in western Montana for food. And they were a particularly ruthless bunch, almost kind of mafia-esque, if you will. And, you know, they intimidated the local populace. And so the soldiers would have to deal with them. They would have to patrol the park for tourists and any transgressions along the main road. So, you know, hunting poachers was kind of backcountry stuff, whereas tourists, you know, they would follow the main routes. And the majority of tourists that are coming in are going in on these kind of organized trains of stagecoaches, but there are some tourists that come in and just kind of camp along the sides of the roads. Well, they would leave fires burning and things like that. And so, well, that was another job of the soldiers, was to patrol and make sure the fires are out, making sure they're not getting too close to the geysers or getting themselves in a position of danger with bears or things like that. So they would have to go around and you know, basically talk with people and tell them, stop doing this and you're not supposed to do that, or, you know, put your campfire out, things like that. And that's where I think some of the social tensions for sure come into play, when, you know, you have to tell civilians, hey, knock it off, you're not supposed to be doing that. But at the same time, that's not what soldiers are trained for. You know, soldiers are trained for, you know, fine, especially in the late 19th century when, you know, we're trying to emulate the great Prussian cavalry and, you know, big charges and, you know, maneuvers on the battlefield, you know, going off and, you know, telling tourists to put their fires out or whatever. That's not exactly what they're trained to do. Then at the thermal features, because Yellowstone's a very dangerous place. All those thermal features and all that boiling water, man, you can get yourself in a world of hurt pretty fast. Well, the soldiers were there to tell tourists to knock it off, as well as to not vandalize it. One of the things tourists would do is they would carve their names on the thermal features, and soldiers, you know, would have to tell them to not do it. Well, here, especially when you've got the wealthy people who like to go and put their names on it, you have this soldier who is a coming from at least a working class environment, telling these rich posh people to knock it off. And if you don't, I'm going to arrest you. I mean, it can create some tension there. And, you know, people would try to bribe their way out of it. And, you know, soldiers would have none of it, at least in some cases. In some cases they might have, but we don't have the sources for that, unfortunately. But they, you know, they would see them do these kinds of things. And so this policing element kind of creates what I call a social legal paradox, whereas socially the people enforcing the laws are of a lower social class, but they have greater legal power over their social superiors. And that created some tension, which is why I think, I delve into some of the psychological theories about this kind of tension, that, you know, why they, you know, are, you know, maybe wantonly drinking and shooting their guns on the decks of their soldier stations as a way to release that tension that they're feeling, because they're not always treated well by the people below them. And, when Rudyard Kipling came into the park, he talked about how the soldiers who would, provide these types of duties, they would be abused, or not, you know, the tourists would want nothing to do with them. And even Rudyard Kipling, who himself is, you know, slightly snobbish, he felt so bad for these soldiers that he would sit there and talk with them. Although he did kind of look down on him. He said, "Well, the British cavalry is clearly superior to these guys," but he does give a very interesting view of you know the tourists and their interactions, and particularly in terms of policing with the soldiers. And so those would be some of the things, but probably the hardest job they had to do is fighting forest fires. The, fires would break out in the park and the soldiers would, at that time, the idea was is natural fires, unnatural fires. You want to preserve the park no matter what. So they would go out and they would fight the fires, and it was hard backbreaking work with soldiers who weren't trained necessarily to fight forest fires, particularly in the wilderness, and they didn't even have the equipment to do it. And so, they're out there just kind of making it up as they go. And even the post commanders are very frustrated with this effort. And it's some of the newspaper accounts and some of the superintendent reports are very colorful in their descriptions of what a rough duty that was. And it was hard, it was brutal, and the soldiers aren't trained for it. Now, the advantage of the military here is that they were organized. And so, you could, with unit organization, you might be able to fight fires fairly effectively, but man, it wasn't what those soldiers signed up for. And they certainly didn't have the equipment to do it for a long time. And getting that equipment from the Department of the Interior was oftentimes very, very, contentious between the military superintendents and the secretary, and then also Congress.
Yeah, and so these soldiers are doing things that they're not trained to do. And so you talk a bit in the book about kind of the soldier's response. And so we've talked about that a little bit. Can you just talk about a little bit more about the sense of just isolation that these people are feeling because there's so few of them patrolling a very large area? Can you just talk a little bit more about the isolation and kind of the way that they were dispersed? You talk a bit about, I think it's chapter 3, where you talk about the various areas of the park and how they're kind of distributed and which I think kind of would help to illuminate kind of the sense of isolation that a lot of these soldiers might feel.
Sure. The main fort is a place called Fort Yellowstone, and it's the headquarters of the park, and it's at Mammoth Hot Springs, which is just inside, it's about 3 miles inside the northern border of the park. It's still the park headquarters today. And traditionally, that was the jumping off point for what was called the Grand Tour. The roads in Yellowstone are basically a figure eight, and they follow the original stagecoach from the 1800s stagecoach route fairly well today. So if you ever see a picture of Yellowstone, there's like this figure eight of roads, and that's basically the same as it was back then. And at the top of that figure eight is Fort Yellowstone. And that's the headquarters. And that was where most of the soldiers were stationed. However, Yellowstone is huge, and it's, it's at 8,000 feet, it's 2,000 or so square miles. There's a lot of wilderness there, and there's a lot off of those roads, a lot of places off those roads. And the two things that they needed to do, like I mentioned, was they had to patrol for poachers, which is in the backcountry off those roads. Then they also had to patrol the more traditional tourists on the roads. And to do that effectively is very difficult. And so they had soldier stations, little outposts around the park. And one of the inspectors who came through in 1902 said, this is a throwback to the frontier, which at this point, in military terms, I mean, the frontier officially closes according to the U.S. Census in 1890, but really in the northern plains, it's, 20 years since there's been, the railroads have come through and really any kind of frontier contention has been stopped. But he said, this is a throwback to the days, 30 years ago when, you would have a post in the American West and you'd have little outposts out around. And he said, that's what's going on here. And so these outposts are around and they vary over time because they build new ones and take some down. And these outposts are basically cabins, usually two or three room cabins. And you would put a basically anywhere between three and six people in these. You'd have a non-commissioned officer that would be in charge of them, and then you know, several privates. And it would be their responsibility to patrol backcountry, to patrol the woods or the roads, and as well as protect the thermal features. And so at where there's thermal features, there tends to be soldier stations. If you go into Yellowstone today at a place called Norris Geyser Basin, they have one of these soldier stations still up, and it's now a museum for the National Park Ranger, and it's a great place to be. It's very picturesque setting. I highly recommend going there if you ever get the chance. But these would be in the literally out there, and you have to realize that in the wintertime, when the tourist season ends, all right, the poaching continues. And so these soldiers would be out there, and they could be, you know, 15, 20 miles from the next soldier station. And it snows, you know, it snows to be 150, 180 inches, 120 to 180 inches, depending on where you are in the park. And so these guys can be very, very isolated. Now they did have, and even in the summertime, it's very isolating, even back then as well. They eventually ran telephone lines around to these soldier stations, although in the wintertime, sometimes avalanches would cut the lines, particularly in the mountains. But they would often, because, and I know this from the records, the orders would say, hey, you can't gossip on these lines. You know, you got to knock off the gossip. It's only for official business. Well, what that's telling me is that these guys are so lonely, and they're stuck with these five people. And yeah, there's some tourists that come through, but they don't have a huge amount, at least positive interaction with that. They're getting on the phone and they're just chit-chatting. You know, I mean, they're trying to, you know, keep in social contact with other people. And so much so that, you know, the commanders are getting a little upset and telling them to get off the line, you know, stay off the phone. Part of that, you have to realize, is the old party line idea, is that everybody on the phone could probably hear what was going on in the other ones as well. But they're trying, they're really feeling that sense of isolation, even in the summertime. And at a place called Sylvan Pass, where I went through really in depth in one of the court-martial records, you also get that feeling of, you know, yeah, you got to go someplace to have these social interactions. The nearest hotel in that particular case, because it's right on the east entrance of the park, was about 3 miles away, just outside the park, at a place called Pahaska Teepee, which was a hotel built by Buffalo Bill. And they would go there and they would talk with the proprietor of the hotel and the people who ran it, with the maids there, because, man, you know, there's not a lot of women around, except for especially women that they could socialize with, other than, you know, the working class maids at these hotels. And so they would go there, and that sometimes led to, you know, when you've got a military base, you've got a disproportionate amount of men to women usually. Now, in this particular case, you've got more maids here. That's, you know, working at the hotels. It's great. But, you know, there's a certain level of competition too. And, the sergeant at Sylvan Pass, he would, time his patrols every Saturday, because they had to patrol to Lake Hotel, which is quite a ways away. He would go from Sylvan Pass on the east entrance to Lake Hotel, which is almost in the center of the park, and that was part of the regular patrol route, and everybody had to take their turn. But he always made sure that he could time his patrols for Saturday, because there was always a dance Saturday night at the hotel at Lake, where there was more more maids, and so he would always time it and do that. But I mean, that's the efforts that, you know, they're riding hours and hours on horseback just to you know, socialize with, in this case, people with the opposite sex, but just other people as well. And so, you know, I mean, they're really isolated. And when you get into the wintertime, man, you got to imagine how tough that is. You could go, you know, you're stuck with five guys, you know, five, six guys in a little three-room cabin, and you can't even really get out a whole lot. Yeah, you're supposed to go patrol out in the winter, and so you get some skiing and all of that, but you come back. I mean, this is like being in an Antarctic research station, you know, and actually I pull in some in the murder of Private Cunningham, where at Sylvan Pass, I kind of bring in some of the medical theory about that, which I thought was very interesting, about, you know, what does isolation, this deep, heavy isolation, do to you? And, you know, I mean, you're there, you don't have a lot, there's no way to get reading material. And so, you know, one person who was in charge of a different station, one by Old Faithful, said, you know, the cards get worn out, your playing cards, all you can do is play cards anyway, and they get worn out. The reading material, you've read all the reading material, and so, man, you're done with that. You can talk with the people, but I mean, you know, after 6 months of talking with the same six people, what all do you have left to say? And so, you know, it can create some real interesting social situations, which, you know, led into that murder at the Sylvan Pass. And you know, there's biological elements to it too, because they didn't have, you know, I mean, they're even more isolated because, you know, they don't have always phone access if the phone lines are cut in the wintertime. And, you know, you can lose or have your a particular hormone called T3 that reduces, which can make you more irritable. It can, you know, and any parent who's been living through the COVID isolation will tell you, you can become more irritable with your own kids. I'll guarantee it. And you get more irritable, you get short tempered, and in some cases, in that particular case, it turned very deadly. So.
And so you talk a little bit about, I mean, there's always the very kind of dramatic choice that a soldier can make, which of course is desertion. Can you tell us a little bit about how that played out?
Well, yeah, Fort Yellowstone actually had one of the highest desertion rates in a military post west of the Mississippi, so much so that they had to have their own investigation, which I found was very interesting. I was at the National Archives and I was going through the military records and came across this one that they actually were, the U.S. Army was so concerned about the desertion at Fort Yellowstone that they did a special inspection just to try to figure out why soldiers were leaving. Now, this is what I think is interesting, because we have a tendency to assume, well, of course, this has got to be easy duty. And when you read like Aubrey Haynes's Yellowstone story and stuff, they really talk about, oh, yeah, oh, you know, well, some soldiers may not have liked it, but this was easy duty for them. You know, they're in a beautiful place. And we would assume, because it's today a very popular tourist destination, 4 million people go there a year, we would assume that, oh, this would be a cherry of an assignment, right? You would love it. The soldiers didn't like it. And the report goes through and it lists several reasons why there was so much desertion there. And there's a number of factors that I thought were very interesting. One of which was tied to, you know, just things that are typical at any military unit, which is, you know, you got officers or non-commissioned officers who are, you know, unpleasant, not very good at their job, treat their soldiers poorly. There certainly was some of that. The commanding officer for Yellowstone had said, oh, it's because the recruits that are coming in are just really bad recruits. They're really poor recruits, and it's because of them that we have this desertion. Well, the inspectors found out, yeah, there's occasionally some, but that's not really the main cause of this problem. They said, well, there are some things that are unique about the park, this posting in the park. One was, it was so isolated, so very isolated. The only town was this place called Gardner, which wasn't very big. And, you know, a couple dozen buildings, you know, shanty buildings. And for the most part, you know, it could be bustling during the summertime, but in the wintertime, there wasn't much left in Gardner other than the prostitutes, which the soldiers would go to frequently, and the barkeeps. But nonetheless, that was the only place of entertainment, unless you really wanted to take a big long trip to a place called Bozeman or Livingston. But that's a ways away, certainly by those standards. And and regular rail service, you know, especially when the tourist season ends, you know, trains only go a couple times a week. So, you know, Gardner was it. And other than that, they were on their own to entertain themselves. And so the isolation of the park, much less being isolated on the interior of the park, that was tough. One of the ones that really stuck out to me too was the multiple soldiers apparently referred to as the disrespect to the uniform. And that was, as I pull in all the other sources, I think what we've been already talking about, these people looking down on soldiers as their social inferiors and clearly showing disrespect to them, particularly in their legal, you know, enforcement duties. You know, they saw themselves, even though they had to redefine kind of their idea of being a soldier to including also being somewhat of a police officer, if you will. You know, the fact that these people were disrespecting them. I mean, when a policeman tells you to do something, you're supposed to do it in their mind, right? Well, you know, they're being shown the disrespect by some of the episodes where you know, the tourists are you know, not doing that. And so, you know, that led to part of it as well. And you know, so there was a whole myriad of reasons. It was what the inspector called an undesirable posting, which is very interesting, especially because most of the historical literature on this, which again is fairly scant, tends to assume that this was good posting and people liked it. And even some of the signage around Fort Yellowstone itself now, because there's a kind of a walking tour in Yellowstone of the old fort, talk about that, oh, this was a good duty and they liked their duty here. Well, that might be true for some soldiers, but not for all of them. And at certain times, particularly around 1908, when they had that in that special investigation, it was very clear that the park itself was undesirable, that being stationed there was definitely undesirable. I mean, it was harsh duty. You're asked to do not only regular soldier duties, but also additional, you know, duties that you may not have ever really wanted to do. The abuse from tourists. Yeah, it was not always a pleasant place to be.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's one of those places that's really nice to visit. But living there, especially back in those days with few utilities, the isolation, it just must have been a much different. Obviously, it's a much different experience than today. I mean, even living there today would be somewhat isolating, even if you've got internet and TV and all of that stuff. But there's still the sparseness of people. But back then, without having any of those amenities, I can see that.
Well, so I don't know. I mean, I loved living there. It was great. I had a time of my life, but you know, it wasn't for everybody. So, and it still isn't, but you know, it is, you know, visiting and living, you're right, are absolutely different things.
Yeah. Especially for people that didn't grow up in that area. I'm sure it's probably different if you're used to it, but yeah, somebody coming from, I don't know, the urban West Coast or the East Coast, that would be quite a traumatic dramatic change.
So let's talk about the interesting part about that, I think, though, is that it also showed the Department of Interior, that soldiers weren't really suited for this. I mean, eventually, I mean, they were there for 30 years. They were there for a generation, for crying out loud. But eventually they start figuring out that soldiers aren't what is needed, and that they need to have someone who can be in the mountains and stuff like that. So really the soldiers, even though the administrative, and this is where all the historical literature is, that the administrative element, you know, helps create the National Park Service. But the soldiers, and more importantly, what the soldiers were not, actually leads into, you know, well, what is it we need? It begs the question, what is it that we should have if we're going to not have soldiers? Who should be more effective patrolling the park? And so it kind of leads into that thing. That was a decade long discussion they had. That's a third of the history of the military in Yellowstone was that discussion about, you know, well, soldiers aren't it, but what should it be? But what they weren't was as much as what they were that helped create the National Park Service.
Yeah, so let's talk about the end of the military era there. So obviously we've got a lot of, they've built up a lot of experience and a lot of knowledge about how this is affecting soldiers, but also learning what soldiers do well there, what soldiers don't do well there. And so what were the lessons that people learned from this military occupation? And then how did that influence the transition to civilian rule once the military left?
Well, what they found first and foremost was, I mean, the social tension was actually fairly significant, because it's real interesting that the soldiers were not allowed to go into the hotels unless they were specifically invited, and then they had to be in their dress uniform and things like that. But they were not allowed to go into the hotels to enforce the park laws. Now, this is really interesting because it's like this designated sphere of influence where, you know, these rich hotel tourists are like, hey, we don't, you know, we need to have our break from these, you know, social inferiors who have a power we're not comfortable with over us. And so, you know, they end at the door, and then everything is correct and right inside kind of a domestic space, if you will, of the hotel where they had their social apparatus, which is interesting because, you know, okay, alcohol is not supposed to be sold in the park, but guess what? Every park hotel had a bar, and the soldiers couldn't go in and enforce it. And so, you know, they could do whatever they want. Well, you can't have that. I mean, and part of this is, you know, after you get into the early 20th century, you know, in the progressive era, and there's kind of this democratization, if you will, going on that's at least trying to chip away at some of these, you know, class distinctions. You know, the recognition that if you're going to enforce the rules, you have to have people that are talented, which the soldiers oftentimes were not. I mean, like I said, they didn't have the skills. They weren't trained in it. They learned it. By the time they learned it, they were usually shipped off to somewhere else. So you got to have someone that has the skills. You have to have someone who has the motivation, which many soldiers did not. And that was very clear because I think you have multiple streams of evidence on this, not the least of which is you have written sources saying that, oh, yeah, there's no hunting in the park. But guess what? Soldiers are hunting. And they're not even really hiding it that much. One sergeant is going through the park and he's actually writing his brother in kind of a diary format. And he talks about, oh man, they're going to eat well this winter, man. We had some venison for dinner tonight and they're in the middle of the park, right? They had something. Well, the only way they're getting that is by, you know, hunting the game in the park, which they're telling tourists not to do, but they themselves are doing. So they're not very motivated. Some places there were reports that the soldiers were actually working in cahoots with some of the poachers. Oh yeah, there's a big herd of elk over there, so go ahead and help them. And so they weren't clearly motivated. They probably were not real motivated to engage in the policing of tourists, because that, at least from what I saw in the records, was not a pleasant interaction, usually interacting with tourists and trying to enforce laws. So, you know, they probably weren't motivated for that. It's probably not why they joined up. In fact, there were some cases where tourists who kind of wrote these travel diaries talked to them. Well, you know, the soldiers say this isn't, you know, they expected to go to the Philippines because there was kind of a insurrection or a war, really, real nasty one, actually, going on in the Philippines. That's where they thought they were going to go, but they ended up going into the park and having to do this duty, which wasn't what they signed up for. And so they weren't motivated. So they don't have skills. They're not necessarily motivated. And they're also not acceptable legal enforcement to the people with whom they were, you know, in charge of policing. And so much so that, again, they're excluded from the hotel. So when they put together, you know, when they start having this very long discussion about, you know, what it is that they should be, you know, if they're not going to be soldiers, eventually it's like, well, you got to have people that are trained, that know what they're doing, kind of like the scouts that they had hired. So you need to have them. You need to have someone who's socially acceptable. And you have to have someone who's motivated. Well, they eventually are able to do that. And they are, you know, whereas there's, you know, a couple hundred soldiers during patrolling the park, which, and they always wanted more soldiers, is very interesting, almost over the parks. Like, it's so big, we need more soldiers. But when they create the National Park Service, they do it with a couple dozen, and they do it more effectively. Now, part of the reason for that is that they pay the rangers better. And so they, according to at least some of the superintendents, you know, they can attract a better class of people to be rangers, but they also know it. They're motivated. They understand the region. They understand the job. And because of that, then they're probably also a little bit more socially acceptable enough to be able to go into and enforce the rules within the hotels as well. Now, part of that too is that the strict class lines, you know, of say the 1890s are really weakening significantly by 1918, 1920. But nonetheless, you know, I think part of that is playing out as well. And so, you know, what the soldiers were not is pointing them in the direction of what they needed for the rangers as well. Now, interestingly enough, you look at ranger, you know, even today, modern park ranger uniforms, they look an awful lot like World War I era military uniforms, and that's not by mistake, because the Army did bring a lot of its traditions in there. But, you know, you go from a couple hundred soldiers to a couple dozen rangers patrolling the park more effectively than ever before. Yeah, part of that is that they were able to get people that were more talented to that had talent and motivation to be able to do the job that a couple hundred men had done before.
Yeah. And this is a, like I said before, this is a, it's a really fun book and I encourage everybody to check it out. But before we go, can you tell us what's next for you? Do you have any new projects on the horizon?
Well, there's a chapter actually that from this book that didn't make its way into the book. It's kind of a fun book. I mean, as you know, historians don't usually think about market potential. I just wanted to write this book because I thought, you know, I'm interested in social class. I'm interested in Yellowstone. I thought it would be a great book, great story to tell. And I didn't write it as particularly one that would have market potential. But when I submitted it, the editors thought that, oh, yeah, this does. And some of the in the peer review process, the peer reviewer said, oh, this is great, except for chapter six. And chapter six, which didn't make it into the book, dealt with another court-martial case, again, extraordinarily rich detail, about a soldier who was court-martialed for performing immoral acts on other soldiers. And yeah, and this was consensual, so don't get me wrong here. It was very interesting, very, very fascinating chapter. But because it dealt with sexual content in the National Park Service, doesn't allow books with sexual content to be sold in the park. I think they're thinking more of the historical fiction oftentimes sold in the bookstores. There was a little bit of give and take about whether that chapter, and I really wanted that chapter because I thought it really showed a lot of what soldiers' lives were like, sexuality being a part of that, but also, you know, the social interactions that were going on. It was a very fascinating chapter. And I kind of stuck to my guns, which actually probably delayed the release of the book here. And I talked with people on, you know, some of my colleagues about this on campus. I delivered a paper last summer at Historicizing Masculinities at the University of Newcastle in England and talked with people there about it. And they're like, well, you know, I admire you. And they were a sympathetic audience. They loved it and they thought it was great. But they also said, you know, here's the deal. Even though university presses are in theory not, you know, always interested in making a profit, those books that do sell allow other books by scholars, which are very important books, to be sold. And so it turned out not to be as black and white as I initially was making it. And I relented and let it go. But so now I'm kind of I've shaped it up into an article. Although it's long enough, I could maybe make a little micro history out of it. There's a book that I use in my class on the Renaissance called A Modest Axe, The Life of a Lesbian Nun in Renaissance Italy by Judith Brown that takes one particular kind of court case of a nun or investigation of a nun and her sexuality. And it's very, very enlightening. This was called Micro History. I could probably make it into a small book like that if I really wanted to. So I've toyed around with that idea. But that's the immediate one. On the long term, my goal is to continue looking at the court martial records, because I think those are greatly underutilized, and I'm a big proponent. I mean, again, one of my minor fields is my master's degree was early modern Europe, and microhistory is a big thing there, and you know that's a whole other debate, you know, about the benefits and limitations of microhistory, but microhistories oftentimes give this glimpse into the world of people who don't normally leave otherwise written records. And I think that if using these court-martial records, you can start to get a little bit better view of life in the military out in the West particularly, but I think you could expand it, you know, for soldiers in the 19th century. And I'm going to look at the West probably and look at some of these court-martial records and what they can tell us about life, even though they're exceptional cases because obviously they get court-martialed or whatever. But, you know, they can give you a real interesting glimpse into the world of the common soldier where their voice actually comes out in ways that we don't traditionally see. And so I'm going to start collecting. I've already started collecting a few of those. I think that's where I'm going to go with that is how these court martial records can really enlighten us to otherwise silent groups in history.
Well, those both sound like fascinating projects, and I look forward to seeing what comes out of those.
Well, me too.
So thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, Dr. Rust.
You bet.